Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and Happy New Year! My guest this week is Philip Iskov, a writer and producer juggling some very interesting projects at the moment. He's also the co-creator of Sleepy Hollow, which returns for its fourth season this Friday at 9 p.m. on Fox. Phil picked Curtis Hanson's Wonder Boys, the director's unlikely follow-up to his 1997 breakout L.A. Confidential, another adaptation of a tricky novel, this time by Michael Chabon, but radically different in almost every other way. Wonder Boys is a modest study of a middle-aged author in crisis, with Michael Douglas's Grady Tripp's entire world spiraling into chaos over one wintry weekend in academia. It's now remembered as the movie that won Bob Dylan an Oscar, but nearly 17 years after its kind of shameful release, there's plenty of stuff to rediscover if you're willing to look, or if you're looking for the first time. There's plenty of stuff to discover. I'm delighted to be able to kick off 2017 with this one. Please enjoy. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I think that it never got the love that I think it kind of deserved. I mean, I guess there's a lot of things about it that I love, but I remember when it came out, and I was surprised that Curtis Hanson had chosen this as the follow-up to L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, it didn't really seem to step in step with his filmography either.
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, and then he followed that up with 8 Mile, which is even more of a step in a totally different direction. Yeah, I think I just sort of... I believe that it came... Yes, it certainly came out after I read Cavalier and Clay, the Michael Chabon book, which still is probably my favorite book. I hadn't read Wonder Boys, and I went to see it, and I think that it just sort of spoke to me on, as a writer, anything, any movies that romanticize writing is going to connect with me on some level. But it didn't feel elitist. I think that there are a lot of movies about writing. There are a lot of, you know, books about writing. There's lots of art about writing. Sure. But they can be very navel-gazing, and they can kind of climb up their own ass if they're not careful. And they can make it seem as though they're changing the world, which isn't the case.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, kind of what I loved about this movie. It also feels, having rewatched it again yesterday, it feels like a warm, worn-out book. Like, it feels like... It, you know, browning pages and you know, folded corners. It feels like some old paperback that you, like, crawl into bed with. Even just, like, the color scheme of it, it's all browns, and it's all, like, everyone's wearing cozy clothes, and it's, like, raining, and it feels lived in, snowing. Like, it feels like autumnal. You know what I mean? It just has these qualities to it that make it very inviting. And you just want to be hanging out with these people. Like, it is kind of a hangout movie in a lot of ways, too.
It really is. It's much looser than I remembered.
Yeah.
Because it is, it has a farce structure, but it plays out in... I think it was Ebert who said that it plays out slowed down. It's a calm farce.
Yes. Which is indicative of the novel, which is quite meandering.
And the perspective of Grady Tripp, who is...
Yes, a high, writer who can't stop writing.
Yeah, he's not fully connected to his world except to his keyboard. Mm-hmm. And so everything that happens is happening around him rather than to him.
Absolutely. And he's also, there's a line in it that sort of in a lot of ways encapsulates the movie. It's near the end when, after Katie Holmes attempts to read his book, and she says, you tell our class that writers make choices, and it didn't seem like you made any at all. And that really sort of sums up the movie to me in a lot of ways. That idea of we all make choices, right? And if you don't make choices, you take the risk of treading water and not moving forward and not doing anything. And that's what Grady is trapped in, which is this idea of a book that never ends because he just can't find the ending. Yeah. And because he doesn't want to make the choices that will actually bring closure and consequences or movement forward or whatever the case might be.
Which is reflected in his immediate life that weekend as he's incapable of responding to his wife leaving him or his girlfriend's pregnancy or indeed anything else that's happening. It is Michael Douglas in 2000 was not an actor associated with stasis. No. And that makes it really interesting as well.
I agree. It's without a doubt one of my favorite Michael Douglas performances, because it doesn't feel like a Michael Douglas performance. And I like Michael Douglas. Mm-hmm. I think that War of the Roses is one of my favorite comedies ever. I think that no one plays a dick better than he does. So for him to play this sort of almost a kind of Robin Williams-y kind of character is really not his bag.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, one of the reasons the movie probably wasn't very successful was that it was Michael Douglas playing against type. Paramount didn't really give it its due.
It opened at the end of February in 2000.
Yeah.
With a photograph poster that was basically just Michael Douglas with snow near him.
Yeah.
And it says, hey!
Yeah, come see Wonder Boys.
Yeah, from the Oscar-winning screenwriter of L.A. Confidential. Yeah. Those things line up.
Yeah, they don't. I think one critic said that the poster made him look like Elmer Fudd.
Oh.
And I think that on some level it kind of did. I mean, he had these glasses on the tip of his nose and the scarf, and he looked like a Robin Williams character. I think that it's also interesting too to watch the movie, you know, before Tobey Maguire became Spider-Man, before Robert Downey Jr. became Tony Stark.
It is kind of amazing that this film has Rachel from Batman Begins, Tony Stark, Peter Parker, and Hank Pym.
Yep.
Frances
McDormand, who was in Transformers.
That's right,
now.
All just hanging out.
Yeah, they're all just. It's pretty amazing to watch. It's also just really, really likable and lovable. Like. Even when the characters do things, and it does dip its toe into some pretty dark waters at times.
Yeah.
You get the impression that they're hinting at James potentially trying to kill himself that night outside.
That's pretty much established. Yeah.
And it's, they don't hit you over the head with it, but, it's certainly alluded to.
Yeah. I think it's as fuzzy as Grady's perception of it would be. Like everything is just a little loose and out of focus and things can be interpreted in different ways.
Yes. I love that scene, though, of them outside the house. The snow, like, the snowflakes look gigantic in this movie. Yeah. I love how just the snow is just so, inviting in a weird way. And that beautiful scene where they're talking about, you know, that's what heaven looks like. And the greenhouse. There's just also something very, part of this also stems from, I was developing this project this year that was basically a cop show. With no technology for all intents and purposes, not to get into it, but it was just sort of, and I long for those days as a writer when we didn't have technology. And when I see movies like this, like no one has a cell phone really in this movie.
There's a lot of payphone action in this.
You see a computer once at the very end. It's mostly typewriters.
Yeah.
It feels just very vintage-y. And I love it. It just, it makes it so much more, it forces the characters to talk to each other, to engage in things. I think the technology has made, it makes, unfortunately, our characters very passive. It doesn't make them particularly active. And that's a bummer. I mean, even just at the end when they're trying to figure out where he lives and Katie Holmes looks in a phone book.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, that's so quaint.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff that, I don't know, not to be like nostalgic, but it is kind of a nostalgic movie. It feels like what we all wish the collegiate experience was like.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That I think Roger Ebert actually said it interestingly when he reviewed the film about how it feels like the faculty feel in colleges. That idea of the kids come and go, but the faculty lives there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They have a house on campus. Like it's all very familial in a weird way, which I also really love that.
And they've built this bulwark of their own self-importance around themselves where that faculty party, you know, just this whole word fest thing is... Mm-hmm. It would be insufferable, I think, to just wander in as a civilian.
Yes.
You have to be steeped in that culture to even care at all.
Yeah.
That Rip Torn is there being jerk, you know, like just so ludicrously big and self-absorbed, but also kind of fun to be around. Like he's enjoying that. And that's where the performers become important, I think, too. Richard Thomas is, I mean, you know, like he's an inherently dull actor if you give him the wrong material.
Yes.
You need to make you need to make use of his dullness, which this film does. Where
embracing it,
he's obsessed with a jacket. Of course, she'd stray. Yeah. Like there's all this stuff going on.
There's also, you know, Michael Chabon has a ability to sort of metatextually fold pop culture into itself a little bit. In all of his books, you find that he finds a way to sort of not just romanticize the things that he feels make sense within the construct of the of whatever that piece is, but you know, you've got Marilyn's jacket, you've got this sort of iconography that exists within all of his books, but it's done in a way that doesn't shine a big bright light on it. It just sort of exists. This, you know, Frances McDormand's husband has, you know, Marilyn Monroe's jacket, and is obsessed with the marriage of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. You've got James Lear's obsession with all of these old movies, you know, the Douglas Sirk movies.
Yeah, he's carrying Written on the Wind around on VHS in his bag.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Which is just, it's really interesting. I think that as someone who tries to do that in my writing, it's tricky. You know what I mean? I think that I probably veer much closer to the Joss Whedon camp of how I deal with pop culture in terms of wrapping my arms around it and having fun with it and basically looking at the audience and being like, wasn't that thing great? Don't we both love that thing? Chabon is much more literary about it and is far more subtle about it and does it in a way that is a lot more intellectual, I guess, is one way of looking at it.
Well, certainly in Wonder Boys, the idea that Thomas's character is constructing a thesis on the last American marriage. He's not wrong. Like, that's a really interesting book if a good writer writes it.
Sure.
There is something in there that makes me think that it's not just a thing that is slapped onto another thing for resonance.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's also the kind of thing where characters within the film and in the audience people can simply look at it and go, that sounds kind of obvious and dumb. You'd have to be really smart to make that work. So it sounds pretentious, but also potentially good.
Just the titles of the books of which we never get to read, but like The Arsonist's Daughter sounds like a great book.
Yeah.
Don't know what the hell it's about.
Yeah,
it sounds like an important book. It sounds like a book that would win an award.
Yes.
You know, and James's The Love Parade.
The Love Parade.
Don't know what that's about, but it sounds interesting. Yeah. And it sounds like a title that a 19 or 20 year old would write a book about.
Yeah. As opposed to so many other films that just come up with these weird connections or, you know, slap two words together that sound interesting or as some, I wish I could remember who said it. It's such a great observation, but you know, Passengers is the movie that Andy and April would go see in Parks and Recreation and make fun of.
Yes. Yes. Which, and by the way, I've been rewatching Parks and Rec recently. It's the best.
It really
is. I basically cried every episode. It's just so beautifully, I mean, right now, The West Wing and Parks and Rec, for obvious reasons, are my everything.
Sure.
I'm holding on to them desperately with the positivity and hope that politics can survive.
Yes, they're movies about people who work together to do good things.
To do good things.
For people who do appreciate them.
Exactly. But yes, there is something very inviting and believable about Wonder Boys and what Chabon does with that world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also something that I found interesting in rewatching it, too, was its depiction of depression and how people deal with depression. You know, Grady obviously smokes and drinks and writes a never-ending novel. James is obviously dealing with, you know, he has his movies and he has his own writing that he's sort of dealing with, but maybe not as successfully. And then obviously Crabtree, it's sex and it's, you know, to a certain extent drugs as well.
Yes.
And it's just sort of it doesn't, and again, this might be the reason why the movie never really connected with people, but, you know, it never really stakes a claim on things. It's, as you mentioned, it's very fuzzy. It feels like Grady's, you know, mind. And because of that, it sort of dances around things and it circles things and it makes observations about things and then it kind of flits off into another direction. Sort of like the wandering mind of someone who is either intoxicated or high or you know, just bouncing around. It pinballs a lot, which I think might also be a reason why it never really connected. But
yeah, when Paramount reissued it the following November, I think it was.
Well, the November of the same year.
For the Oscar consideration run, which doesn't happen anymore.
No.
And was really
rare.
Yeah, it was rare and it was laudable. It felt like, yeah, it didn't feel like a contractual obligation, which it almost certainly was. Somebody else saying, hey, come on, put it back. Let's. I want this. I don't know who it was, whether it was Hansen or Douglas or just Rudin. Yeah, yeah. Probably Rudin. We've met a couple of times. I wouldn't put it past
him. No, I didn't.
The sense that you were trying to, and again, this was at a point where I don't think it was out on tape yet or DVD. I don't think it had been released before the reissue, but it was an attempt to make people notice.
Yeah.
To call back to an era where, like, again, Bush had just been elected. I can't explain this to people who weren't there. This was a time when nothing good was happening. Like, everybody was just depressed. The Supreme Court had just given...
Yeah.
Or no, they hadn't even stopped the recount yet. That was happening. It was like the middle of November.
As this movie came out.
And this little film burps out. And I can see how, if you were of a particular conservative bent, you might think that it's everything that's wrong with America. Because it's about pot smoking, it's about the gays, and it's about, you know, they shoot a dog, and there's a transvestite. And all of it now seems...
Quaint.
Quaint, and... Yeah, the film, I would love to see it play with the contemporary audience just to see how they would respond to the way the film treats all this stuff. Because I was watching and thinking, like literally everything in here could be screamed at as problematic by someone who didn't watch the movie and just saw
pictures. Progressive,
It is. Yeah, and it's trying. Like, it's trying to be inclusive. It's trying to be understanding. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fully define, like, the running thing about Crabtree is that he'll fuck anything, but that he's probably gay, but he won't say so. Like, there's even a line where Douglas refuses to, or Grady refuses to quantify him, and then whatever James is also up for grabs.
Yeah.
Except that Crabtree knows.
Right. So, I mean, it's a reoccurring thing in Chabon's books.
Sexual confusion.
Which I don't want to speak at a term, but I'm pretty sure was something that Chabon himself was dealing with as well. Mysteries of Pittsburgh, his first novel, was very much about that. And him sort of coming to... He's pretty openly bisexual and talks about that sort of sexual fluidity, if you will. It also comes into play in Cavalier and Clay as well, with Sam Clay being gay. It's interesting because it's not like Chabon and in turn Wonder Boys doesn't really care that there are people that are gay. Like that, and by that I mean it's just like they're people and they're gay and let's move on with our lives and who really cares.
Or they're part of the story and here they are.
Yeah, exactly. This is just a trait that they have and Chabon doesn't try to get on a soapbox about it in any real way, which I think is interesting. I think that that's the way any trait of a character should be for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
So I think there is something interesting. There's actually a shot in it that I never noticed until I watched it again yesterday. It's in the tail end of the movie when James and Robert Downey Jr. have sex, and the next morning Grady knocks on the door, opens the door, and Robert Downey Jr. says to James, "This is good." He points to his book. He's like, "Yeah, it's pretty good." And he leaves. And Robert Downey Jr. turns to Michael Douglas and says, "I'm going to publish this."
Yeah.
And there is a look of, quite frankly, jealousy that crosses Michael Douglas's face. It's a moment of... there is so much going on in that reaction shot. And it's a testament to Michael Douglas's abilities as an actor that he can do all those things and then go right into a joke and say, "Oh yeah, it's been a long time since someone wrote a really good book in jail."
Yeah.
And I think that it's a beautiful moment where you sort of see a man that feels his mortality, that feels like am I not relevant anymore? He wants this younger guy now. Is he a better writer than me? Have I lost it? Am I, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's all in 5 seconds of screen time.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
And it also bolsters the idea of Grady as a writer because he's open to the world
and
feeling everything in a way that he doesn't usually in the film. Like we don't see him take much in. He's not the observer of the film, even though he's narrating it and we are effectively seeing his version of events.
Yeah.
He's the guy who is stumbling through, he's Elliot Gould in The Long Goodbye. He's paying attention, but he doesn't show it. He's just sort of...
this passive observer.
He's being pulled through all these events right up until whatever happens.
Yes.
And then he rides that.
Yeah, he seems very... he's pretty reactive.
Yeah.
He doesn't actually move the story. The story kind of, as you said, pulls him through it, reluctantly, which again is part of sort of this, he doesn't want to make choices, and the movie and the story is forcing him to do so, which I think is really interesting too. It's also, and I don't know if you knew this or not, but, so Chabon was writing a book at the time.
Yes.
And called Fountain City, I believe.
Right, and this was based on his relationship with his writing teacher?
With his writing teacher, and he was writing Fountain City with no end in sight. It was just like Grady Tripp's book. And he basically just stopped and wrote this book amidst that sort of writing block problems that he was in, that sort of maelstrom of creative difficulties. And in its own way, sort of like how Barton Fink was written in the when the Coens hit writer's block in Miller's Crossing, and they didn't know how to end it, and they wrote this thing about writer's block, and it's one of their best movies. And I just think there's something very interesting about writing to get out of writer's block. You know what I mean? To just turn the page, move on to something else, jump into a different sandbox, see what comes out of that, and great things can come out of just taking a step away from that thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's also a sort of a really interesting part of, I think, the movie, of just a guy who, whether he knows it or not, he has to do these things in order to get away from this book. You know, I have to say though, watching it again, when the book blows away at the end, it really was like a gut punch this time. I don't know if it was because, it's been a while since I've watched it. Mm-hmm. Obviously I was a writer when I saw it and whatever, but for some reason this time I was just like, oh my God, like, I don't know what I would do.
Right.
I think that, his reaction is appropriate because I think the book had gotten away from him anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, no, to see that metaphor literalized is kind of perfect.
You know what I mean? Just like, well, now it's really gone. Like, now it doesn't... I think you would either have to just kill yourself or just, like, say, it's over. And I'm just like, I got to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. The punchline to that, at least at my screening, was the... quiet. Well, do you have a copy? Do you have any copy? And all he says is, well, I have an alternate version of the first chapter. And the audience wouldn't stop. They rolled right over the next two lines. It was so great. It's like,
there's also, the line when she says, what was it about? And he's like, I don't know. And he's like, then why were we writing it? Because I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
Which isn't
funny so much. It's just really, really sad.
Yeah. There's a lot of lines in it that, the scene that I always kind of get choked up. I mean, I'm a bit of a hopeless romantic, so it is what it is. But the scene in the atrium with Frances McDormand when he's fallen on the ground and she wakes him up and she pulls out the gun and she puts it and she goes, pow. And he says, you got me. She says, I love you, Grady. It's just, there's something, first of all, they're both a love story about people that are over, let's just say, 50?
Sure.
Something like that.
He's supposed to be 50-ish, even though he's...
Right. And she's probably 60. Mid-40s, is my guess.
She's not supposed to be much younger than he is.
Right.
Definitely older than his wives.
And able to have a child. So let's say she's 42-ish, something along those lines.
Yeah.
You don't see that very often. Two people that aren't, you know, matinee idol looks, and it just... That the love story that exists within this movie is a love story between people that we don't necessarily generally see falling in love.
Sure.
Also makes it special. To see two people that... some people would have given up on love by that point, I think, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think... And it's debatable whether or not Grady's ever really loved any of his wives.
We have no input into...
Like, you know?
No insight or information about
who he was. At all, really. And in an interesting way, it almost feels like, you know, Michael Douglas's career has been littered with, many, a woman much younger than him, and any number of sexual escapades. So it felt right let this be sort of the evolution of that to a certain extent, of a character that has, that wants to put all of that. Of course, he then married like Catherine Zeta-Jones, yeah. So like whatever. But
I think they were together at the time, right?
Maybe.
Because they were shooting, they were together in 2003 when they were shooting Chicago here. Or she was shooting Chicago here. And yeah. I was actually at a restaurant once where they were in the next booth, and I was just trying really, really hard not to eat because sure, that's sure. fascinating.
Yeah.
You want to hear
he's a bit of a weird dude.
I assume.
Yeah.
But but they were, I think they were already an item, or they were about to be. But the, yeah, and well, you mentioned the episodes, which was something this time watching through his seizures or whatever they are. I was trying to track them and figure out if they mean anything.
That's interesting.
It's the weirdest device because it doesn't
It's arbitrary.
It is completely arbitrary. Yeah, it doesn't have a conventional payoff.
Yeah.
It's there to make you think there's a larger arc.
Yeah.
And it's... I find that fascinating because it's like the opposite of the trope of, you know, coughing and blood in your hand. It just happens and then it doesn't happen anymore. And I find that just wonderful that it wasn't excised in the adaptation because it might feel too obvious and that Shevin thought of it in the first place. Yeah. And it's clearly, like, if you want a reading that's dramatic or character built, it's his body telling him to stop writing this fucking book.
Yeah.
Because
it's killing you.
His body doesn't want to do it anymore, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah.
The idea of typing these pages out.
Yeah.
But there is no, there's simply nothing. It just, it's there and then it isn't. And the depiction is really interesting that, you know, it's the always white, from his perspective. We never see the seizure itself or whatever happens.
Nope.
We have no idea how bad it is. Like, there's never any froth or anything. There's no sense that it's,
but it's medical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He just drifts away and comes back.
Yeah. It is. It definitely is. I mean, there's a... If you want to say the climax of the movie is probably that moment when he almost falls over the banister.
Onto Alan Tudyk, who's another remarkable discovery. What the hell is Alan Tudyk?
He's fantastic in it, though. Yeah, the whole scene where he asks about Errol Flynn rubbing things on his dick is amazing. Yeah, I guess that's sort of, on some level, a bit of a forced climax a little bit of, is he gonna die? Is he gonna fall over this thing? I would say if I have, you know, listen, we can nitpick and I have criticisms, I'm sure, but if I have one beef with it, the ending feels a little pat, you know what I mean? That final scene of him.
Just that he gets everything he wants. And...
Yeah. And just, I didn't really love, they like clean up everything and they clean him up and they shave him and they put him in front of a computer and, I didn't really necessarily love that so much. Yeah. I like that he ends up with Frances McDormand. Obviously, I love that they have the child together, and that's all fine and good. But I can't. I'm a little at odds with myself. Listen, it's so fast. It's less than 5 minutes of screen time at the very end, and it gives people the happy ending that they want. I think there was a way to do it without exercising so many visual things that we had become so accustomed to and quite frankly loved about it. I didn't love him in a new house with a clean office, and I was just like, okay, like I get it, but I didn't need it.
You could see it in David Koepp has this great maxim about going out on the potential for happiness instead of happiness itself. So it's much more interesting to stop when you know things are going to be okay if they don't fuck it up and still have some faith in your characters.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think in this, I was thinking about it just last night watching it again myself and realized that all you really need are the words on the screen. You don't need to know anything other than seeing him type it or even his voice and then just the save image, which is, of course, the dual metaphor of yes, he's learned, yes, he's evolved, and also he's saving himself.
Isn't he?
But it's still...
I think that... I honestly think that if the scene was the scene and he was in his office at the house that we've grown accustomed to, everything would have been fine. I mean, you put that computer in that room, in that crazy, crazy room in that crazy house, it's somewhere in between the two.
Right.
You know, and you see Frances McDormand pull up with the kid. Like, you can have all of that.
Right. Or you don't show her pull up and you just have the sound of the car pulling up and a knock on the door. Something to imply. But we don't... Yeah,
I didn't mind her pulling up with the kid. That was less of a beef for me because... And more of just sort of the visual component of, like, now he's wearing a turtleneck and he's shaved. And I was like, oh, Jesus. Like, that to me was just like... But again, these are nitpicky things because everything else worked up until that point.
Well, I wonder if that isn't Hansen's background too, as a commercial director, like not a director of commercials, but a very commercial filmmaker,
sure,
making sure the audience gets what they want. Because that seemed to be a real issue after Confidential, right? Because it was such a, people didn't like the ambiguity. People were, you know, like, it's great, but why does it have to be so dark? Well, because it's an adaptation of a James Ellroy novel.
Yeah.
Where have you been?
Yeah.
And then with Wonder Boys, he's doing something lighter and looser.
Yes.
And I just wonder if maybe he needed to put the bow on it, that it was his own thing.
Maybe. I mean, I guess my feeling is, if you need that, you're watching the wrong movie.
Yeah.
Like, you've watched almost 2 hours of this Shaggy Dog, weird, you know, kind of meandering thing. A 2 minute scene with a just feels sort of like a different movie. It's sort of that, that's, it was a little jarring to me. It felt a little bit like, meanwhile, in a different movie, now he's wearing a turtleneck, and it just, I just don't think you needed it. But again, like, if that was the thing that got Paramount off his back or whatever the case might be in order for him to be, then sure, fine. I mean, then it makes sense.
The only recent example I can think of where this was really obvious is the F word, or what if it was called in the States. Daniel Radcliffe's
Doctor Zen. Saw it,
It's really sweet, and it ends on a perfect moment that subsequently continues into 5 more minutes of movie. And it's just like, there's this beautiful end credit sequence. One of the Kazan's characters is an animator, and there's these little interstitials that run through the entire film, and her characters return for this sort of photo album of what happened next. Sure. And then the movie just basically has a scene where that all happens too. Like, you just watch the actors get back together at the airport later to talk about the thing
that happened.
The end credits will tell you. And I just found it, and everybody, Ilan Mastai and Michael Dowse and Radcliffe all said the same thing, which is that, well, people just wanted it. It was the thing we needed to do. And it screened at TIFF without it. And that's the version I saw. Yeah. And then afterwards, everybody's like, but then what happened? But then what happened? But then what happened? And they said, we'll do this. We'll give you this.
Yeah.
And it made them happy. But, you know, the movie doesn't need it.
It's hard. I mean, I...
Well, The Witch does it too.
Because now it begs the question of, like, do you do what the audience thinks they want at the expense of the thing you made?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think that it's... I see both sides of the coin. There are so many movies that I've seen that I love the ambiguity of how they end, and doesn't bother me. But then there are some films that I feel like I respect them for not pulling their punches and just sort of... I mean, like the end of La La Land, for instance, which, you know, I loved it. I thought it was great.
Me too, and it has to end that way.
It kind of has to end that way. I mean, there's a part of me that... I saw it twice. And the first time I saw it... I actually liked it more the second time, I think, than the first time. I felt like it kind of hit a bit of a lull in the center a little bit.
Yeah, it does have a dip.
It has a little...
just stop singing for a while.
People stop singing, and inevitably, Emma Stone's character is going through more than Ryan Gosling's character is going through. So there's a kind of an imbalance of stakes, I guess, between the two of them. But that final sequence is not just indicative of the old style movies that used to do this to a certain extent as well, of the sort of the road not taken, but that last look between the two of them is a perfect way to end the movie, of a sort of lovingly, you know, we had a great thing, and that's fine, and now we continue our lives on different paths. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that don't love that ending, that wish that Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling ended up together and they ran off into the sunset. And you kind of get that in a Michelle Gondry weird way.
Yeah, they find... that's what I love about it, is that he finds...
he gives you both.
Chazelle finds a way to give you both. Yeah. And tell you that one is preferable to the other, which is even better.
Yeah.
I mean, and you must deal with this sort of thing on a weekly basis, because you are constantly upending relationships and changing things in ways that maybe audiences... I can't imagine what, say, Whedon goes through every time he kills somebody. I assume he just has to go hide for a while.
Well, it depends on if you allow the internet to bother you.
Yeah, I suppose.
And I would say that I fall somewhere in the middle camp. Potentially my Twitter feed proving otherwise.
Well, that's it, right? We live in an era where your phone can tell you it hates you 36 times a minute.
Yeah. It's tough. It is really hard to have, you know, real anger thrown your way about something that you love. I mean, I think that there's, you know, it's interesting because I often try to put myself into the headspace of myself when I was anywhere from 15 to 20.
Right.
When I was, you know, in love with a television show. And if I had the opportunity to tweet or speak to or converse with the creator or co-creator or whatever of that show, and they did something that I didn't like, would I have the, quite frankly, the balls to be able to say some of the things that these people say to me? And the answer is no.
Right.
For me. Right. Now, that was a different world.
Yeah, we're old enough to remember a time when you know, fandom meant respect in a way that it doesn't anymore. Like no. Just and a mutual respect. Like the sense that even if a film betrayed me, you know, my expectations, if something disappointed me, I didn't want someone to die for it. It just seemed a bit...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had any death threats, thankfully, for the most part.
But those weird, exaggerated...
There are some very exaggerated people out there that have drawn their own conclusions about things that are not true, that are just, quite frankly, false. And you're never really going to convince them otherwise.
Sure.
I would say that fandom has now sort of turned into a palpable love and a palpable hate. There doesn't really tend to be much in the middle now, or at least on Twitter,
those are people who just
watch stuff. I can gauge.
The quiet ones.
And I understand why they got upset about, you know, Abby leaving the show. And I understand that their misgivings about the way she was written off the show and whether or not whether or not they felt as though the character deserved a different ending. And I understand all of that. I really do. And I think that they, are justified in their opinions. But they're their opinions.
Yeah.
And that's the really hard thing to sort of get across is, you know, I understand that you're frustrated about the show, and I hope, and I don't say this just for my own self-serving reasons, but I hope that they can see, you know, I've seen the premiere of season 4 and that they can see the potential of the show still. You know, I think that what excited me about it was, and obviously other people as well, but the runway that Ichabod Crane gives you as a character, the idea of the stuff that can be played with. So that stuff is exciting. Mm-hmm. But to your question, I think, in terms of episodic television and the sort of the caveats that come with it in terms of, the twists and turns, right? Yeah. And you have to keep people engaged, and especially in broadcast, maybe more so than in cable.
And the story is going to want to evolve. That's the thing.
It has to evolve. Is part of it too. Mm-hmm. I think that people are going to inevitably have their versions of the way things can go. We're also in this unfortunate time right now, and I'm guilty of it as much as maybe anybody, of wanting to figure out where it's going to go before it goes there.
Yeah.
Which is just like, why? I mean, now, admittedly, I do it more times than not with things that I don't maybe care as much about, where I'm just sort of like, you know, I don't want to name drop shows that I don't care as much about. Sure. But I will say that there are shows that I have, you know, that I'll be like, oh, well, okay, I'll go on Reddit and see what people have thought of on this bit.
Well, I mean, Westworld is famous for it right now. Like, it's a film where...
That is a show.
Timeline theories were going back and forth on the first episode as to who things were and what things were.
Now, I will say that show... I guess the problem, and I put that in quotation marks, but one of the things that comes with making a show like that now, in a sort of post-Lost universe is that... there's really only so many variations of this thing, right? So just enjoy where it's going. And, you know, Lost is a prime example of a show that you either enjoy the journey or you're obsessed with the destination.
Right.
And for me, I just thought the journey was great. I thought the ending was absolutely satisfying for me. It didn't bother me. But I can understand a person who was given so many little things, and then when those little things didn't add up to something that they felt was satisfying on a certain level, I can understand that being frustrating. Mm. So I imagine on a show like Westworld, where HBO is basically begging people to go down the rabbit hole every week on this show. I mean, they want you on Reddit. They want you doing this stuff. Inevitably, you're going to be disappointed on a certain level because the things are just not going to be as revelatory as you think they're going to be.
Right. They will be, and you've already guessed them. Like, that's the other thing, right? The gaming to me is, if you're going to be validated, then great, but why, that's 5 hours from now.
Yeah.
Like, you're just never, you won't be satisfied if you go in knowing.
That's why, for me, and not to jarringly bring it back to Wonder Boy. I will say that I do feel like, the movies and television shows that tend to speak to me the most are character-based. And it's not to say that Lost wasn't character-based or that Westworld isn't character-based, because they are.
Sure.
But they are also deeply mythology-based. Yeah. I think that mythology is a witchy mistress. You have to be very, very careful with it. I think that if you start... How can I put this? Mythologies are smoke and mirrors in a lot of ways.
Well, they have to be.
They have to be.
Because if you can see them,
right,
they won't work.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that if you become focused on that, and if that is the thing that you care about as a viewer, as a writer, it's very, very dangerous. I think that when everything is said and done, the human condition, why this character does what this character does, and that emotional investment in that character needs to be the thing. If that's not the thing that you're hooked on to, and you're interested in the smoke monster, you're inevitably going to be disappointed, because when you open that nesting doll, there's probably not much at the center of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with all of it, and it goes back to Chris Carter with the X-Files, realizing that that's what people wanted and then trying to write into it, and you see what happens. It just metastasized on him. It comes into several other different things, and he starts humping all these pieces together. With Lost, I don't care. I mean, I'm afraid of the smoke monster. I'm interested in it,
sure,
but I'm much more interested in who's not going to get eaten and what that means to them.
Sure.
With Wonder Boys, what I was going to say is the ambiguity of figuring out who these people are is infinitely more interesting to me than what Grady's novel is about.
Absolutely. And I feel like in a lot of ways, The Leftovers is a sort of a prime example of that to a certain extent, which is I liked season one. I saw that, it was bumpy. Season two was unbelievable.
I haven't seen season two.
You really should watch it. It's fantastic, and it's completely, it has nothing to do with the book for all intents and purposes. It's its own animal, and it is a really, really delicate balance of the two things we're sort of talking about. There is obviously a supernatural event or whatever you want to call it, but that hovers over the entire show.
Right.
But that it's about these characters dealing with that, and what does that say about them, and why are they making the choices they're making? Excuse me, and the grief that comes with it. That's the stuff. That's the goods for me. My roommate, she struggles with The Leftovers, I think, a little bit because of the fact that to her it can feel a little bit like Look at the Birdie when it comes to some of the. I don't know if supernatural is even the right word, but the genre elements that exist within the show. I think there's that's a valid thing to say. For me, I'm holding on to the characters, so it doesn't bother me as much. Mm-hmm. But I think that is something that Wonder Boys does incredibly well, which is, as I mentioned earlier, these characters just feel so real. Like, you just can't help but feel like they just feel like people you want to be friends with. And for a lot of people, that's not enough. I read a lot of reviews about this movie that just felt like, who cares?
Yeah, like a collective shrug almost. And I was surprised to find those now.
I did too. I found myself just going surprised a little bit. But I also wonder too, if it was released today, Which I don't think it ever would be. I don't think this movie would get made today.
That would be an HBO special. It would be like four hours long. It would be a lot more book. It would be a lot more typing.
Potentially.
Or three parts. One, like the first night, the second day, the third day.
I
could formally sell it by breaking it up, but I don't think it would work as a feature.
I mean, that's a little bit too of what I found interesting watching it again yesterday was that sort of the nostalgia of a movie like this even getting made. I think that it's not that it... Maybe I'm being a little bit hard. I think that... I don't think Paramount would make it today. A24 might.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And Aperna might. I think that, you know, Fox Searchlight might, you know, distribute it.
Yeah, with the right director.
With the right director, I think that maybe it's still possible. I know you haven't seen 20th Century Women yet.
Yeah.
But it does feel in a lot of ways like a movie like this. It does have that kind of hangout quality. You know, I think Mike Mills is a tremendous filmmaker, and the movie has there is kind of a little bit of Grady Tripp in Annette Bening's character.
Okay.
And there's just so I don't think we're completely DOA on movies of this ilk. And I think that great actors will always be drawn towards great roles. So in that respect, I think, you know, that makes it kind of special too.
Yeah. I wonder if now it's a question of the package isn't enough. Like it's no longer enough to put these people together and make a $40 million picture because what's the release strategy?
Yeah,
it's going straight to SVOD.
Marketing.
How do you make it work?
Yeah.
But I would also love to be able to just take the DVD into a room and start whacking people with it until they watch it, which is probably how people are going to sell their
picture. Yeah. There is, I mean, I think that that's maybe the most disheartening thing about the business now. As someone who's trying to sell things, mm-hmm. and trying to come up with ideas that are saleable, is that the package is now a thing.
Yeah.
You know, literally and figuratively, in terms of what entities are you bringing to this? How are you making this thing?
Is this that four quadrant thing where you have to
a little bit of that and a little bit of it used to be the idea is king and a great idea is a great idea and we're going to make it. Now it's a great idea with, you know, a feature director and an actress or an actor and, you know, any number of other pieces of talent attached to it. So it becomes, and I'd also say too, like, you know, True Detective opened a lot of doors and changed television. But it also, you know, Pizzolatto wrote two or three episodes of it before he sold it. He had, you know, he had Fukunaga attached to it. He had Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. You walk into a room with those type of, you know, entities. Yeah, no shit. It was bought to series and went to series.
Right.
But and now
those things didn't come back for the second season, and everybody got mad at it. Yeah,
right. Well, yeah, that's a whole other thing. But yeah, I mean, now it's just like you have to. Now they're like, well, this is the bar, so you better hit this bar.
Right.
That's a tall order.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, so this at least brings us to the final question of the show, which is always the same, which is what of Wonder Boys have you borrowed or stolen or lifted or absorbed into your creative DNA? Do you find yourself referencing it at any point or just thinking
about it? Oh, very much so. There's actually a project that I've been, that I'm trying to get legs underneath, that's based on a book. I don't want to say what book it is, but that it's based on a book that takes place at a college, a boarding school. And Wonder Boys is very much a touchstone for me in terms of not just the faculty element of it, but just I feel like we've gotten away from shows about schools in a weird way.
Mm-hmm. Well, unless it's like How to Get Away with Murder,
right? That's sort of right. The genre which is a fantastic show, but the stakes are so jacked up,
right?
In a show like that, that the sort of academia of it is not really so much of a priority.
Yeah, no, it's not about going to school. It's not about
being, right. You know. So I'm intrigued by trying to find a way back to that.
Okay.
Which I think that this movie does really splendidly in terms of a really kind of loving. That idea of the warmth of education. I know that that's you know, can sound whatever. But I think that, you know, we spend a large portion of our adolescence going to school and growing as a person. And I think that we forget how sort of comforting that is. And I think that's sort of one of the things that I try to hopefully convey in some of the stuff that I'm writing, that sort of the comfort of, I guess camaraderie, I guess, is a big one too. They all feel like they're friendly and friends with each other. And that moment we talk, sort of that idea of like sitting down and wanting to hang out with these people, that's always something that I hold at a very, very high esteem in terms of my writing. I want people to want to hang out with these people.
Well, I mean, for television, you're literally inviting them into your home. That's kind of what you want for any kind of appeal, right?
Like, yeah,
to
for
be
sure.
Relatable, but also interesting. Yeah,
absolutely. I think. I mean, but also to be very careful too, because I think that like I think the industry holds likability as a sometimes takes that too far. Sometimes that idea of like people can't be you can't question anything about that. This person has to be perfect,
right?
We can't make them unlikable. And you're like, well, I mean, they can be likable and complicated too. Like that's okay. It doesn't have to be, but
you know, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, Jesus, I just think about all my favorite characters are, if not short tempered, they're at least eccentric.
Sure.
You
know, sure.
Who wants to hang out with people who are perfect?
Apparently broadcast television
studio executives.
But I mean, I think, but you know, the flip side to that is that we've had anti-heroes for a very long time too.
Sure.
You know, I think that people want to watch Tony Soprano on a television show. I don't think they want to spend any time with Tony Soprano. Yeah. I could be wrong. I mean, do you want to be in a room with Tony Soprano? I don't know the answer to that.
What if he's teaching criminology at a boarding school?
Oh, there you go. Perfect. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, I think that in terms of other things that I tried to take away from Wonder Boys, I think it's wry sense of humor. I'm a pretty sarcastic person, so I think that there's definitely there's some tremendous jokes in the movie that are not it's like you said, it's kind of got farcical elements to it, but it never goes. It knows it's smart, it knows it's clever, it knows it's witty, and it knows it's making a joke, but it's more of with a wink and a nod than it is with a swinging for the fences, belly laugh, which is, that's certainly my wheelhouse.
Yeah. They're not making movies like that these days. And I definitely would like to see more of them.
Yeah. I feel like we're in a weird place right now.
My thanks to Philip Iskov, whose Sleepy Hollow rolls into its fourth season on Fox this Friday, January 6th at 9 PM. Check it out. See what's next. And keep an eye on his IMDb page for the other stuff he has brewing. It sounded pretty interesting off mic. You can find Phil on Twitter at Philip Iskov, all one word, and you can find Wonder Boys on DVD only from Paramount Home Entertainment, but it's available for sale and rental in HD on iTunes and Google Play. I keep hoping Criterion will get behind a Blu-ray release, but with Hansen's death late last year, that seems unlikely. Let's try writing some letters. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. For 2017, I've resolved to stop doing the quote thing at the end of the show because people found it confusing. So I'll just say Happy New Year again, and thanks for listening.